The 1997 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 315. What part of no don't you understand? A meditation on the ethics of gaining knowledge and the utility of anti-intellectualism by Harlow Soderberg Clark.
Good morning. I'm Linda Lindstrom, chair of this session entitled What Part of No Don't You Understand? A Meditation on the Ethics of Gaining Knowledge and the Utility of Anti-Intellectualism. Our presenter is Harlow Soderberg Clark. He is an adjunct instructor at Utah Valley State College in Orem, and he's also a freelance writer. He has a BA in English from BYU and an MFA from the University of Washington. He lives in Pleasant Grove, Utah. He's married and is the father of three sons. Harlow?
Thank you, Linda. I appreciate the introduction. It is a joy for me to be here with you. About 12 years ago, I had taken a year off from graduate school to attend to some pressing problems, and I was wondering whether I should go back to school. My mother did what parents sometimes do in like situation, she sent me a copy of my patriarchal blessing. And I had the experience many people do in reading their patriarchal blessings of finding great significance in one part for my present situation. At one point, Brother Baloff, the patriarch, had paused and said that as I needed a special blessing, I should be aware that there is much good to be found in the learning of the world and that I should seek that good through the Spirit of the Lord. Reading my blessing reaffirmed a conclusion I'd come to as an undergraduate, that the gospel gives us an elegant set of tools to analyze and use and profit from the learning of the world. And I returned to graduate school. All learning, all quest for knowledge takes place within a social context. Now I should back up here for a moment and note that I've changed the title of the paper slightly. The title is Leave My Soul Alone. Or, what part of no, and that's K-N-O-W, don't you understand, Meditations on the Ethics of Gaining Knowledge. Ivory Tower intellectual is a term of derision, of course. So I was surprised to find somewhere in my reading that was coined by an intellectual, Balzac perhaps, who said that the artist and scholar must insulate themselves from their society in a tour d'ivoire. The irony is that a scholar writing in a tower of ivory would still be part of a social circle, a circle including all the authors he or she was studying, and the scholar would hope all the people who would be reading whatever issued forth from the ivory tower. Social context is so important in our lives that without it, we perhaps do not exist, as Steve Walker once found in a thought experiment. When we were discussing Conrad's Heart of Darkness in Steve's Modern British Literature class, he told us about an experiment he conducted once. The novel is about a trader named Kurtz who goes deep into the Belgian Congo, finds that he has no moral center and is a hollow man and falls into savagery. Steve had asked one of his classes to imagine what they would have left if they stripped away all the social institutions, family, church, neighborhood, school, friends, etc. I only did it once, he said. In my final paper for the class, I argued that Marlowe, the narrator, is the true hero of the novel because he is the one who returns and brings back the boon, the story he has been telling the other sailors, which has allowed them to travel into the heart of darkness and return safely. I argue that to be hollow is not to be devoid of moral beauty. When Mary calls herself a vessel of the Lord, the imagery is of a hollow container inviting the glory of the Lord to fill it. It is no accident of language that the word we use to describe partaking of the Lord's Supper, communion, is the same word we use to describe the people we live among, community. If we cut ourselves off from our community, as Steve's thought experiment suggested, we have no hope of our hollowness being filled. In the margin of my paper, where I mentioned the experiment, Steve wrote, "This still haunts me." Let me suggest, then, to you a thought experiment. Imagine your son or daughter at college were to participate in an experiment, and the following was the unanticipated but predictable result. It's important to note that, though unanticipated, the result is predictable. Within 20 minutes, he was reduced to a twitching, stuttering wreck who was rapidly approaching a point of nervous collapse. He constantly pulled on his earlobe and twisted his hands. At one point, he pushed his fist into his forehead and muttered, "Oh God, let's stop it. and yet he continued to respond to every word of the experimenter and obeyed to the end. The experimenter, in writing up the results of the experiment, notes the extremity of this reaction, but also notes that, in a large number of cases, the degree of tension reached extremes that are rarely seen in socio-psychological laboratory studies. Subjects were observed to sweat, tremble, stutter, bite their lips, groan, and dig their fingernails into their flesh. These were characteristic rather than exceptional responses to the experiment. One sign of tension was the regular occurrence of nervous laughing fits. 14 of the 40 subjects showed definite signs of nervous laughter and smiling. The laughter seemed entirely out of place, even bizarre. Full-blown, uncontrollable seizures were observed for 3 subjects. On one occasion, we observed a seizure so violently convulsive that it was necessary to call a halt to the experiment. Imagine, if you will, how you would react if this were describing your son or daughter. If you were a department head, or our department head, how would you react if this happened in your department? How would you react if it happened to you? I can't answer for you, but I can tell you my own story. As an undergraduate of BYU, I enjoyed several graduate level classes, including one where we explored the work of Will Cather. As a young boy, my mother told me about Death Comes for the Archbishop, where the Indians come up onto the mesa and throw the tyrannical bishop off the edge. And my father, a lover and teacher and writer of literature, told me of his admiration for Cather's short novel, Neighbor Rosicky. Much modern and contemporary literature is a portrait of hell, but my father said it's easy to make hell dramatic. Cather did something much more difficult. She made the life of a good man dramatic. I greatly enjoyed the class. Only one thing marred it for me. Toward the end of the semester, a group came into our class enlisting our aid in a project. They wanted us to take a personality test, and we obliged. A few weeks later, they came back and said, "Well, we need to debrief you." Seems there was a male professor on campus, religion department, I believe they said, whose attitudes were very sexist, and some professors were afraid that he might be doing psychological or emotional damage to his female students. Their interest in our class was the several men studying a woman writer. So you wanted to find out if men who are interested in women writers have some kind of different psychological profile, Sister Ronald asked. "Yes," they said. This all made me very, very uneasy. If my understanding of euphemism and implication were correct, they were trying to get someone fired or disciplined in some way. Of course, I don't know if my understanding of euphemism and implication was correct. I didn't feel comfortable enough to voice my objections. In taking the class, I hadn't considered Cather's gender at all. I hadn't even considered that Marilyn Arnold is a leading Cather scholar. I didn't know that. Just that she had studied under my father, and they have great admiration for each other. I felt insulted and violated to be labeled as the man who isn't sexist because he reads women. I doubt I would have participated if I had known what the tests were to be used for. We were told it was a class project of some kind. The use of deception to gain knowledge is widespread in our culture. We use deception in everything from sting operations and infiltration to debt collection and psychological experiments. The experiment mentioned above, where sweating, trembling, nervous laughter, stuttering were characteristic responses, and 3 subjects had full-blown, uncontrollable seizures, was designed to produce stress in the subjects so the experimenter could study how people reacted to one particular stressor. Of course, he didn't tell his subjects that. He told them they would be participating in a test of how punishment affects learning. They were to teach sets of words to a man strapped into a chair, electrodes on his arms and scalp, and administer a series of ever greater shocks and learn the words correctly. Of course, the man in the chair was an actor, deliberately making mistakes and receiving no shock at all. So the purpose of the experiment was to see how big a shock the subjects were willing to give before refusing to participate. The nervous laughter and stuttering, the sweating and trembling, were unanticipated consequences, but were they unpredictable? Milgram designed the experiment to cause conflict between the dictate to obey and the imperative to do no harm, the teaching from earliest childhood not to hurt each other. This means the experiment was designed to cause stress. Milgram emphasizes this repeatedly. Subjects who resisted were told the experiment requires that you continue. They were never given the option to end the experiment. If it was going to end it, they would have to break it off themselves, break with authority. Milgram felt he could reasonably assume that people would spare themselves the stress and disobey, especially without someone to force obedience. But if you set up conditions whose purpose is to cause stress, is it not also reasonable to predict that the subjects will feel stress, even intense stress? But even if the answer to that question is no, how often does a seizure have to happen to be predictable? If one subject develops a full-blown, uncontrollable seizure, one might reasonably assume a second could, and if a second does, one might reasonably predict a third. I'm troubled that Stanley Milgram says he only broke off the experiment in one case, or in the case of one of those seizures. I was standing at the bus stop across the street from the New Haven Green one day with my missionary companion, not far from Yale University, where this experiment took place, when a man fell to the ground and began kicking wildly, arms flailing. Now that's a full-blown, uncontrollable seizure. Imagine, please, picking someone up after a seizure like that and saying, "The experiment requires that you continue." The phrase Milgram had his actors repeat whenever they encountered any resistance from the subjects. Now I should note here, my niece Meadow has seizures, mostly petit mal, and she would prefer after a seizure to simply continue what she was doing. But this situation is different. Milgram is asking someone, some two to be precise, who had just had a seizure, to resume the activity that caused the seizure. I have probably given you enough information that you recognize the experiment. If I tell people I'm writing about Stanley Milgram's obedience to authority, they ask what that is. But if I start describing the experiment, they say, "Oh yeah, the shocks." This experiment is widely known among college-educated people. Teachers often refer to it as a chilling example of what people will do on command. But I had never heard any discussion of the stress inflicted upon the subjects until I started browsing through the book, which may mean the book has become a classic, a cultural icon everyone refers to and discusses, but no one actually reads. I said that all learning earlier, all quest for knowledge takes place within a social context. And I should probably say a little about the social context of Stanley Milgram's work. After World War II, Hannah Arendt, reporting the trial of Adolf Eichmann, commented on how banal evil is, how mundane. Eichmann was not some monster running around with blood dripping from his fangs, but a bureaucrat, a paper shuffler. So Eichmann in Jerusalem is subtitled "A Report on the Banality of Evil." The book offended a lot of people's sensibilities, their sense that evil is extraordinary. Milgram didn't expect, when he set out to test Arendt's ideas, that people would obey him so readily. Neither, by the way, did his colleagues. He says that every one of his colleagues he took the experimental design around to figured that subjects would break off immediately. And he used this unexpectedness in his defense. As you may have guessed, I'm terribly uncomfortable with this experiment, or at least with the status it has in the academic world. Since the experiment involved an ever-increasing voltage of shock, Milgram's interest was in finding out how far the subjects would go before refusing to administer any more shocks. The highest number on the shock generator, 450 volts, was labeled danger, severe shock. The first mention I heard of this experiment was how appalling it was that people were willing to administer the highest shock. It is worth some comment that, until I started reading the book, I wasn't aware that anyone, let alone a large proportion of the subjects, actually disobeyed. I have mostly heard this experiment designed as an indictment of the refusal to take responsibility that seems characteristic of much of our species. This means that Milgram assumes people are free to choose their actions. The experiment would make no sense otherwise. Neither would Milgram's critiques of his subjects' reasons for obeying. Indeed, he laments the division of labor that fragments processes and keeps people from seeing the full effects of their work and accepting full responsibility for their acts. There was a time, perhaps, when men were able to give a fully human response to any situation because they were fully absorbed in it as human beings. But as soon as there was a division of labor among men, all things changed, unquote. It ain't true. Genesis 3, a story which claims to tell the origins of the human race, says that since the beginning, people have been passing responsibility for their acts off onto others. Adam says, "The woman." Eve says, "The serpent." And in one version, the serpent says, "Tradition." Still, Milgram's claim that there was a time when humans took full responsibility for their actions because they saw the full effects of their actions resonates with that most endearing passage where Nephi, son of Helaman, looks longingly 600 years into the past. "Oh, that I could have had my days in the day where my father Nephi first came out of the land of Jerusalem, that I could have joyed with him in the promised land. Then were his people easy to be entreated, firm to keep the commandments of God, and slow to be led to do iniquity. and they were quick to hearken unto the words of the Lord. This resonance makes it difficult for someone from a culture that values human freedom and responsibility as highly as ours does to challenge the experiment. As Milgram says, from each person in the experiment we derive one essential fact, whether he obeyed or disobeyed. If the person obeyed and one believes they had the choice whether or not to obey, how does one challenge the experiment? Especially when one of my first reactions was to wonder whether or not I would have the strength of character to disobey. Being a storyteller, I settled on a story, a retelling of Ethan Brand, Hawthorne's story about a man who spends his days trying to get people to commit the unpardonable sin and ends up understanding that he has committed the unpardonable sin and thinking of human beings as objects to manipulate. I conceived this story 14 or 15 years ago and still haven't written it, but I have a much better idea now of what happens in it. When I set out to write this paper, I thought of invoking that woe the Lord pronounced on those who sought to rewrite the Book of Lehi, the stolen 116 pages of the Book of Mormon. Woe be unto him that lieth to deceive, because he supposeth that another lieth to deceive, for such are not exempt from the justice of God. That's Doctrine and Covenants, section 10, verse 28. There's a good-sized body of literature devoted to the ethics of deception research, including the work of Holland and Orne, experts in the difference between people's behavior in the research laboratory versus outside the lab. My expertise is in language. And as I read, I found some interesting things about Milgram's linguistic choices, about the language he chooses in recording his experiment. One of the stock replies to prod the subjects into obedience was, "The experiment requires that you continue." Such a statement, Milgram says, gives his experiment its own character, as if it were not something made and designed by a person. Quote, "It's got to go on, it's got to go on," repeated one subject. He failed to realize that a man like himself wanted it to go on. For him, the human agent had faded from the picture and the experiment had acquired an impersonal momentum of its own. Yet later on, when he talks about how it was never his intention to cause the kind of stress he saw, he justifies not discontinuing the experiment, the whole experiment, on the grounds that it had to go on. Second example, Milgram cites a couple of subjects who switched allegiance from the researcher to the victim. Now, Milgram did not play the researcher in here. Two people came into the room, they drew lots, and one of them was to be the victim, one of them was to be the teacher. Of course, the one who was to be the victim always got that position. And then a third actor was in there, and he played the part of the experimenter, so Milgram was not in the room. They shifted their allegiances from the researcher to the victim, the man in the electric chair. Milgram notes that they hadn't broken with authority, they had only chosen an authority more in keeping with their moral sensibility. Okay? They hadn't broken with authority, he says. One of his major themes is that he was trying to get people to break with authority. Thus, it is fascinating that in the appendix, when responding to Danny Opsy's play, The Dogs of Pavlov, Milgram invokes as his authority the victims of his experiment. Victims is his word in a slightly different context. In a world in which action is often clouded with ambiguity, I nonetheless feel constrained to give greater heed to this man who actually participated in the study than to a distant critic. The first thing to notice about this is that Milgram is using the language of force. I feel constrained, not the language of choice. I choose to give greater heed. The second thing is the passive construction. Normal English sentence order is subject, verb, object. The Spirit constraineth me that I must not stretch forth mine hand, says Alma to Zeezrom as they watch the martyrs of Ammonihah burn. The Spirit, subject or agent, constraineth, verb, me, object. In a passive construction, the object becomes the subject of the sentence. The verb takes a past tense form accompanied by a helper verb. And the subject, actor, agent drops out of the sentence. I, object. Notice it changes from objective form, me, to subjective form, I, but it's still the direct object of the sentence. I, object. Feel, helper verb, constrained, past tense verb, no subject in the sentence. I feel constrained. Milgram might respond that this is trivial, that passive voice is widely used in the social sciences, but that's simply an appeal to authority, the authority of his discipline. One more example will suffice. In reading what I have of this book, and I haven't been able to finish it yet, I am struck continually by Milgram's refusal to take responsibility for the harm his subjects suffered. Now, if you remember the quote about the three full-blown uncontrollable seizures, another psychologist, Dinah Baumrind, asks, I wonder what kind of debriefing could possibly make that all right with the subjects. In an appendix, he answers one of his critics who says he made the subjects do something immoral by saying that giving an order is not the same thing as forcing someone to do something. Thus, Milgram inverts the traditional defense, I only told him to do something. That is, I was only following orders, becomes, I only told him to do something. This leads into what chills me deeply about the book. Milgram takes great pains to detail the empathy his subjects felt for the people they were supposedly shocking, but he does not show any sign of that empathy for the subjects of his experiment, at least not in the 80 pages I've read so far. Please note what I did not just say. I did not say that Milgram is a man lacking in empathy or compassion. I said he does not show or express empathy in his account of the experiment. We have no idea how he or the other people involved in the experiment feel about the subjects. This is an important point. The subjects thought they were delivering painful shocks to the man in the electric chair and suffered great stress because of it. But that man and the actor who played the experimenter, and I would add Milgram, could see the real harm they were causing to the subjects. Yet Milgram says not a word to indicate that either of them felt empathy for the subjects or broke into profuse sweating or trembling or implored God to stop the experiment. Indeed, the actor conducting the experiment apparently told two men who had just suffered full-blown, uncontrollable seizures that the experiment required them to continue. It is worth mentioning in talking about the concern or lack of concern experimenters demonstrate for their subjects that Milgram blithely reports the experiment was duplicated by another researcher using real shocks, live electricity, on a puppy who yelped, howled, and ran when he was shocked. People often assume that the academic world breeds distrust for authority. Indeed, one of the charges against Socrates was corrupting the youth of Athens. But the academy depends very heavily on authority. When my students do a research paper, I don't allow them to use the National Enquirer as a source, or general encyclopedias, or general interest magazines like Ladies' Home Journal or the Reader's Digest or a host of others. They aren't authoritative sources, and the information therein is likely to come from writers like myself, not from experts in the field students are researching. This raises the issue of how people inside the academy view those outside it. I started by asking you to imagine what you would do if your son or daughter came home and told you they had been put in a situation by some academic that resulted in severe stress for them, perhaps even including a grand mal seizure. By choosing this topic I did for today, I have defied a certain kind of authority. It's taken me years to do it. What if someone who has no formal academic training? How might they challenge the authority of an academic? One way might be by not recognizing the authority of that academic. Knowledge is power, wrote Roger Bacon. Power over, power to control. And like any power, knowledge can be used unrighteously. How do you challenge unrighteous authority? One way is to gain some authority yourself. But Joseph Smith's warnings about power apply as well to knowledge. We are, nearly all of us, disposed to use power unrighteously. There are other perils as well. Two of the philosophy classes I took from Jim Faulkner at BYU dealt with hermeneutics. Hermes was the messenger from the gods in Greek philosophy, Greek mythology. So the branch of philosophy that bears his name deals with the interpretation, originally the interpretation of scripture, and by extension, interpretation in general. Hermeneutics is a relative philosophy, though relative doesn't necessarily mean arbitrary, as Faulkner explained. 11 years ago, I met Donna Darlene Lee. 10 years ago, we became relatives. And 6 years ago, we produced a third relative, Matthew. Our relationship as a family is hardly arbitrary. To put it another way, the truth of a statement is relative to who says it and under what circumstances. Consider the statement, all sessions today are free. It matters a great deal whether I say that or whether Albert Peck does, and whether Albert has a gun to his head when he says it. A few years later, after I graduated, while I was in graduate school, my father sent me a paper Jim had read at the Association for Mormon Letters annual meeting. Now, I should back up here a moment. The classes that I took from him were studying the hermeneutics of Hans-Georg Gadamer, who was a student of Heidegger. There are two schools. There is a school of hermeneutic thought that is rather nihilistic and sees relativism as somewhat arbitrary, if not very arbitrary. The representative of that second school is Jacques Derrida. A few years later, my father sent me a paper Jim had read at the Association for Mormon Letters annual meeting, where he said that Derrida is not a nihilist, but is simply trying to rethink Western philosophy. Now, if you think that Western philosophy is the bedrock of our civilization, and someone comes along and says that Western philosophy simply can't do what we want it to do, that person, by definition, is a nihilist. Just as if you assume that God is a particular definition, a person who is completely separate from us, and someone comes along and says, I don't believe in that kind of a God, well, that person is an atheist, by definition. But Derrida does not consider himself a nihilist, Faulkner said. Rather, he was trying to rethink Western philosophy, trying to re-present the Western tradition, because it had gone wrong. It had departed from the truth, and he was trying to rethink it to get it back on the right track. The paper has important implications because Joseph Smith also made a radical break with Western culture. He proclaimed that Christianity had gone wrong. And yet, we insist that we are Christians. So this paper has important implications for how such a thing works. Derrida didn't completely succeed, Jim said. His re-presentation of Western philosophy became representation. And that's one of the problems with studying. You may become converted if you're trying to learn to counter a position. You may become converted to the position. The paper on Derrida that I mentioned begins with Jim Faulkner saying that as a graduate student, he would 1 week be a confirmed Hegelian, the next week a confirmed Kantian, the third week a confirmed whatever, whoever he happened to be reading that week. He was a convert to the philosophy. And he says, this doesn't necessarily say anything about the power of their mind, it says something about the weakness of my own mind. But that's one of the problems of studying. If you invest yourself thoroughly in an academic discipline, you become part of the discipline and may have serious problems challenging it. An alternative in confronting authority is to become anti-intellectual. Now, that's a term of opprobrium in intellectual circles. No one wants to be called anti-intellectual. But, as the anti-intellectual philosopher Eric Hoffer says, anti-intellectual philosopher, is that an oxymoron? No. No, Hoffer defines intellectual as someone who wants to govern and chooses to couch his need to govern in the language of ideas. They don't need to be good ideas, just ideas. Hitler's ideas were lousy, but he was an intellectual because he sought to govern, in Hoffer's terms. In the world of politics, intellect is power. So we're back to this idea that knowledge is power, now intellect is power, and suddenly knowledge and intellect are not abstract things. They're the things that determine how we live. Intellectuals make the laws. If you are going to be retiring in a few years, you will be affected by what President Clinton did this week, by what he and the Congress did last week. Intellectuals suddenly have a great deal of power. What response do you give to that if you don't have the resources to become a highly educated person? Well, one response is to become anti-intellectual, is to assume or proclaim that the intellectuals do not know what they're doing. The French term for that is Trahison des clerics, I believe. The treason of the clergy. The treason of the intellectuals. Rejection may simply be a way of confronting that kind of power. Every one of us has had the experience, I would imagine, of being bested in an argument, of knowing that the other person really didn't know any better than we did, but was able to put it much better, and being made a fool. Now, there's one more aspect of this that's worth mentioning. In graduate school, the first class I took was a class on the ethics of aesthetics, the relationship between ethics and aesthetics. Our professor had us read the introduction to a book called Philosophical Explanations by Robert Nozick. I was inclined to read that because Nozick had just spoken at BYU shortly before that, and I found his talk very interesting. In the introduction, Nozick says at one point that it is not some mistake of language that the word we use to define a philosophical position and the word we use to define a shouting match are the same word, argument. He says children think of argument as negative emotion, but a philosophical argument isn't like that, is it? And then he goes on to describe philosophers, for example, say a bulletproof argument, a knockdown, drag-out argument. I'll give you another example that I used to my students. First philosophy class I took from Jim Faulkner, we were asked for our final paper to analyze an essay by Michael Tooley. Now, in the essay, Tooley argues that abortion and infanticide are both morally neutral acts, requiring no justification whatsoever. Let's be sure we understand, infanticide is the killing of newborn infants, okay? And Tooley was saying, argues that they are morally neutral actions. Faulkner said to us, there are many things that you can poke around the edge of this argument, and it's likely to irritate you. But, he said, it is possible to slit Michael Tooley's intellectual throat. Okay? Now, Jim Faulkner is not the kind of guy who runs around with a knife slitting people's intellectual throats. He's not a violent man by any means at all. But he told us once that when he uses the language of philosophy, he becomes combative. When he uses the language of the gospel, he is not combative. But when he uses the language of philosophy, he's combative. Now, Nozick goes on to say that a philosophical argument, because of this use of the language of force, a philosophical argument is an attempt to force someone to believe something, whether they want to believe it or not. You're trying to force someone to believe something. But then he pauses and says, but wait a minute. The only tool the philosopher has to force you to believe is language. If you don't like what I say here today, you're welcome to be idiots and fools. You can go on your merry way, and you can be stupid and everything else. That's all I have to force you to believe. I can use tools of persuasion to try and invite you to believe. But all I have to force you to believe is name-calling. Okay? All I have to force you to believe is name-calling. But, Nozick argues, because philosophical arguments are designed to force people, and that's, by the way, why he calls his book Philosophical Explanations, not Philosophical Arguments. Because philosophical arguments are designed to force people to believe, in a very real sense, the only response you have to a philosophical argument, if you can't argue on the philosopher's level, is to be anti-intellectual. So there are several ways in which anti-intellectualism is not so much a rejection of ideas or rational discourse as they are a defense against the unrighteous use of the power of knowledge. I mentioned earlier Danny Opsy's play, The Dogs of Pavlov, and how Stanley Milgram responds to that play. I want to close by quoting something from Danny Opsy. It's important to realize he's not a wild-eyed, radical, British, angry young man of the 1960s. Apsi is an Anglo-Welsh MD, and he has a particular interest in the consequences of medical procedures gone awry. This is a short poem called In the Theater, and when I picked it up after 14 years to read for this paper, I was surprised at how short it is, because it's so intense. In the Theater, a True Incident. He begins with a quote from Dr. Wilfred Apsi, probably his father. Only a local anesthetic was given because of the blood pressure problem. The patient thus was fully awake throughout the operation. But in those days, in 1938 in Cardiff, when I was Lambert Rogers' dresser, they could not locate a brain tumor with precision. Too much normal tissue is destroyed as the surgeon crudely searched for it before he felt the resistance of it. All somewhat hit and miss. One operation I shall never forget. Now the quote breaks off and the poem starts. Sister saying, soon you'll be back in the ward. Sister thinking, only two more on the list. The patient saying, thank you, I feel fine. Small voices, small eyes, nothing untoward. Though soon he would blink again and again because of the fingers of Lambert Rogers, rash as a blind man's inside his soft brain. If items of horror can make a man laugh, then laugh at this. 1 hour later, the growth still undiscovered, taking its own wild time, more brain mashed because of the probe's braille path. Lambert Rogers, desperate, fingering still, his dresser thinking, chronolist, a cisternal puncture and a neural cyst. Then suddenly, the cracked record in the brain, a ventriloquist voice has said, you sod! Leave my soul alone! Leave my soul alone! The patient's dummy lips moving to that refrain, the patient's eyes too wide. And, shocked, Lambert Rogers drawing out the probe, with nurses, students, sister, petrified. Leave my soul alone! Leave my soul alone! The voice so arctic, and that cry so odd, had nowhere else to go, till the antique gramophone wound down, and the words began to blur and slow. Leave my soul alone. To cease at last when something other died, and silence matched the silence under snow. Thank you.
We don't have anyone to comment on the paper today, so we've got time for questions and comments if anybody would like to make any. Can you come up here, please?
No, it's not a question. I would just like you to now restate. I was reading in the, they tell me, I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. Do you really feel that I want to apply this to the church. And what your statement is, and here I understand that you think that it really is a move, that it is for our own safety that we not involve ourselves in this intellectual movement. And you feel that that's really what church authorities are thinking when they're saying stay away from things that are kind of stimulating and different.
I didn't say...
Do you want to restate that, please?
I didn't say that it is for our own protection that we stay away from intellectual stimulation.
Do you think the church authorities
feel
that way?
Let me back up a moment. Brigham Young once said, he was talking about how blessed he felt to have known Joseph Smith. And he said, I feel like shouting hallelujah every time I think I was privileged to know him. Now, think about that statement for a minute. Can you imagine anyone standing up in a sacrament meeting and shouting hallelujah when thinking about Joseph Smith? Can you imagine that happening? Can you imagine someone going up to the stand in a testimony meeting and just letting out a big hallelujah? It doesn't happen in our culture because that's not the way we worship. The structure of LDS worship and LDS culture is very intellectual. We come in, we have speakers speak to the audience, not sermons, speakers, and then we go to classes. Okay? So the structure of our culture is very intellectual. We have within the culture a great many people, and within the leadership of the church, a great many people who hold doctorates. More than, I would think, more than half the apostles hold doctorates. I don't believe that a lot of what comes from the church is a warning against being involved in intellectual things. It's a warning against a particular kind of attitude. And what I've tried to do here is suggest why such a warning might be appropriate, but not to suggest that we all ought to pack up our bags and move into the temple and pick up the scriptures and study nothing else. The 13th article of faith makes it very clear that anything which is virtuous, lovely, or of good report or praiseworthy is worth our attention. Although packing up our bags and studying the scriptures intensively might be a very good thing as well. But does that give you a sense of what... I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last. Oh, in the synopsis, okay. Other questions? Please.
Yeah, would you develop your statement here that anti-intellectualism may be a defense against unrighteous uses of the intellect a little bit more? I assume that you infer that's applying to us as Latter-day Saints somehow. I can't quite bridge the connection between Milgram's experiments and how that relates to us and our intellectual life.
The connection I see is that for me, I simply cannot imagine a responsible researcher continuing an experiment after three people had had grand mal seizures because of the experiment. And yet he says the experiment grew to encompass over 1,000 subjects. And these three seizures occurred among the first 40 subjects. Okay, so I'm using Milgram's experiment as an example of a particularly noxious, unrighteous use of power, the power of intellect we have as often. And when I started writing the paper, I was interested in exploring whether people who adopt an anti-intellectual stance are simply trying to protect themselves from an argument that they can't counter. Not necessarily that particular argument to our culture, simply using that as an example. Does that...
Yes, that simplifies it, but are you suggesting that that adopting an anti-intellectual stance is a way of just not being able to deal with it because they have an inferior intellect or they don't have the education to see through the issue, or
not necessarily? Because as I suggested, if you study an issue enough to challenge it on its own grounds, you become invested in the issue, and may not be able to challenge it. Sometimes the only way to challenge something is from the outside. Now let me back up a moment. The Catholic Church got a terrible black eye, not because they were anti-intellectual, but because they were extremely intellectual. Aristotle was the greatest scientist who had ever lived up until maybe our century. Maybe still is the greatest scientist that ever lived. And the Catholic Church, in recognizing that fact, adopted him as their official philosopher. Now, one of the things that Aristotle did, that is, Catholic theology became Aristotelian. This created a problem because Aristotle developed a cosmology that involved a whole group of circles to account for the motions of the planets. Let me explain how this works. If you take a chart of the night sky and you plot the movement of the planets across the night sky, the planets progress across the sky from day to day, just as the sun moves across the sky from hour to hour. But at some point in the year, the planets move backwards. Instead of moving forward across the sky, the planets move backwards. And I took a class from Nelson, I believe, who treated the whole history of physics as the attempt to solve this problem of the retrograde motion of the planets. Aristotle's way of solving the problem was to develop a whole group of spheres. But between the time of Aristotle and the time of Galileo, people like Johannes Kepler and Tycho Brahe and others had spent so much time gathering astronomical data that Aristotle's model of the universe was outdated. At the time Galileo was writing, there were five possible models of how the stars and how the planets moved. Now, Aristotle's model also happened to be the Pope's model, because Aristotle was the Christian philosopher. He was the official philosopher of the Church. And Galileo wrote a book called Some Dialogues on the Two World Systems. He conveniently ignored the other three and concentrated on his and the Pope's, and made the Pope's look bad. Okay? The Pope didn't like that, as you might gather. Galileo tried to force the issue. The Pope said, okay, you're going to force the issue, I'm going to excommunicate you. And he called in the Inquisition, and the Catholic Church got a bad black eye because they were excessively intellectual. By definition, Galileo was being anti-intellectual in his writing, by definition, because the intellectual definition was Aristotle, and Galileo was challenging that. So anti-intellectualism is sometimes the only response you have. I would even go so far as to say that all intellectual movements begin as anti-intellectual movements. And as far as Hegel is concerned, that's simply part of Hegelian dialectic, I would think.
If you want to accept that, then you might say in the church, the prevailing intellectual movement is the manuals and the correlated system, and those who want to challenge it are the anti-intellectuals. That's going a little bit farther.
Hugh Nibley has analyzed that at length, and he would probably agree with you to a large extent.
I was hoping really that you would want to address a little more what she suggested. What I would call the anti-intellectual movement that's coming from top down is really becoming very pervasive in the church. You hear people in relation by lesson saying things that imply you don't want to listen to the intellectuals and the feminists. It's really crept down to the all levels, I think, and defense against the unrighteous. Is that a defense against the unrighteous uses of the intellectuals that they would define them? I don't quite understand how this applies.
I didn't write this to apply particularly to this situation. My thinking in regard to that was that sometimes the anti, or what seems to be the anti-intellectual stance in the church, is a response not to people in the church, but to the intellectual currents in the world. Now, let me back up a moment and
that's not the way the general authorities are describing it, though. They're
well,
mentioning the people who they would view as intellectuals, who would give presentations at Thessalonians and, of course, particularly church-oriented.
You should know that as far as official things, the Sunset Symposium has never been named negatively. It has been named positively in the Encyclopedia of Mormondom. Of Mormonism. Look up Symposium, I believe that's the title, or look up Sunstone in the index, and it will say Sunstone is good, and it will give several reasons. It includes Sunstone by name, dialogue, and several other things, and says these things are good because they give people who have difficulties an opportunity to work out their problems in a friendly situation, in a friendly setting. Now, that is not official, but it's quasi-official. It was prepared, the Encyclopedia of Mormonism was prepared under the direction of the first presence in the 12 apostles. I tend to see a lot of anti-intellectualism in the church, if that's what it is, as coming from people who are trying to second-guess the apostles, people who are trying to second-guess the brethren. A lot of my friends who are closer to situations like this than I am tell me stories about people second-guessing, not about things coming directly from the top, but about people second-guessing. I'll give you an example. There was a scholar, somewhat inactive, who had written a book about masonry in Nauvoo. And as a matter of courtesy, he sent a copies of the book to several general authorities whose ancestors had been involved. A few weeks later, he was quite surprised. He received a letter from Spencer W. Kimball congratulating him, saying, "We need more faithful people like yourself doing scholarship in the church." And he understood shortly thereafter why he got that letter when a man knocked on his door saying he was from the Brethren, and that he'd better knock off this stuff he was doing with masonry and everything. And he walked into the other room, picked up a letter from President Kimball, handed it to the man, and said, "Here, read this." And I was interested in that story, so I told it to a friend of mine who had written a fairly controversial book. And my friend said, "Oh yes, I have my letter from President Kimball too." So there's apparently a lot of second guessing going on, and I suspect that what we see, if it comes in the church, is from the church as a body of believers and not necessarily the church as an institution. Of course, that's open to a lot of interpretation, or a lot of debate, as all issues are. But that would be my sense of things. Other questions? Thank you for coming. I appreciate you being here today.
Just a quick one. You, I can't hear. I mean, Milgram, you talked about experimental ray shock before, right? Milgram, you have experience with that experiment here. You talked about that.
He wasn't really showing, but
you said three people? Yeah. I never heard
that. No, Milgram said, yeah, most people have. In a preliminary report of the experiment published in the American Psychologist, he said that profuse sweating and stress were the characteristic responses. It's quite wild. There are a couple of experimenters named Orne and Holland who have done some work on the difference between how people act in a laboratory and how they act out of laboratory. Yeah. And they analyzed that and said, wait a minute, there are all kinds of verbal cues that people use to figure out when someone is in trouble. And he said, if you looked at what was happening in the experiment, there were mixed messages, because at one point the person who was strapped in the electric chair would scream and yell and say, "Let me out," but he would only do it when he was getting a shock. He would be silent otherwise. And, if someone's in real pain, they don't shut up until the next shock.
Orton Holland say,
"Look, experiments in psychological subjects know there's deception involved, and many of them use it as a game of trying to figure out what the deception is."
Hey. That's a good point, an experiment. Yeah, I haven't studied so much. Yeah, that's one of the trouble. You're right. One of the trouble with all these social psychological experiments, transferring that to the real world. You know, would you do this? Because you know exactly what you're saying. You know you've got to, this is just not the real world. You know this is an experiment.
So
then you've got real world, yeah. What you conform, that you can do conform in the lab, because you know it's... But that's interesting, though, that he kept. Even though that's ethical. That wasn't his book, I gather.
I haven't found it yet.
But I mean, this came out in something else, and he actually continued.
It came out
after he was causing. I don't know if you had implications of that. I mean, he was being worse than what he was. Yeah, he was abusive intellectual.
Apparently.
Well, it was. I mean, yeah. He's... Yeah, he wanted to continue his experiments on whether half my subjects died or not, right? I mean, he didn't care. He wanted to find out whether people were being obedient to the authorities.
I imagine he would have broken it off.
Yeah, if he died, yeah. I mean, yeah, I think he...
But he took it as far as the convulsions, and that's something to be very uneasy about.
Still, it's not... who's being... I think he had an agenda there to prove how bad people are, or people in authority are, but he was being...
Wasn't
that the reason he all mentioned it?
Partly. He was a little naive. He felt... people in the West after World War II, and this was, you know, from 25 years of the war, people in the West felt that in Germany is part of the West, people outside of Nazi Germany and who hadn't been part of that felt that was really an aberration in human history. And he wanted to confirm that it was really an aberration. And so he says that the results shocked him. But whether his results were valid or not is a matter of fact.
That's a big issue with all these experiments. Yeah. Because, like you said, I mean, people were, you know, they were, that's kind of, you know, you'd be screaming or hollering all the time, right? I mean, you wouldn't be.
You would think so.
So some people are
shocked. Yeah, people just shut up until the next shock came along. But that's what it did.
Yeah, that's the trouble. I mean, well, the trouble that bothers me, these people believe that what they're doing is actually can be transformed to the real world.
The real world.
And it's really...
interesting subject.
You know, the real classic experiment about the three lines where you know, social psychology, where you have three lines and you have the ones, one pick which one's closest to that. You know, when you have confederates in there, you know, all the things people will perform and not perform.
Depending on...
but, you know, the point I thought about that when I studied the psychology, in this stupid experiment, but maybe out in the real world, where I want to conform, maybe, hey, I know like there's God or not a God or something. I might sit down here, and this structure, right? Okay, everybody thinks it's that line is the longest line. It's that long. You know, I ain't going to make a fool of myself for something trivial as that. You know, but sitting out in the real world, a big thing, you know.